This is a production of Cornell University.
It is March 25th at 4:35 p.m., and I'm calling this meeting of the University Assembly to order. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes of the February 25th. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion.
Motion by Mr. Moore. Second by Ms. Schaffner. Is there any discussion on the minutes of February 25th? I am hearing none. Then I ask unanimous consent to approve the minutes of February 25th. Are there any objections? Everybody's eating? None heard. Meeting February 25th is passed. Second item, meeting minutes of March 11th, 2014. May I have a motion to pass those minutes? Mr. McGrath, thank you. A second? Professor Wayne, thank you. Discussion? Hearing none, I ask unanimous consent to pass the minutes of March 11, 2014. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the minutes of March 11th are adopted. Next order of business, vote on updated Resolution 3, bylaws change, reflecting disassociation of the Public Safety Advisory Council of the University Assembly for 4 minutes. Mr. Bunk.
So we already passed this resolution. It was sent back to us by President Gordon because we got basically the alphabet soup wrong. So this has been updated to be correct. So assuming you didn't have any objections before, which you did not, you probably also don't have any objections now as it's now.
There were printouts at the table. Does everybody have a chance to see it?
Yeah.
Essentially, in item 31 through 37, what we're doing in... So last year, we disassociated the Public Safety Advisory Council from the University Assembly. That is done. This is actually removing that section from the bylaws, but appointing a liaison at President Scorton's request to the Council on Sexual Violence Prevention from this assembly so that we're still connected with the process. That's in lines 31 through 37. The rest of it is getting the alphabet soup correct from the previous resolution because we had some of our organizations listed incorrectly. Are there any questions from members? I ask unanimous consent to waive reading of the resolution into the minutes. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the resolution is considered read. Are we prepared to call the question?
Yes.
Mr. Moore calls the question. Can we have a second? All in favor of passing University Assembly Resolution Number 3 revised, please raise your placard or hand. Sorry, put mine down. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Rosemary?
Yes.
10. Mr. Professor, okay, and nays, abstentions, resolution carries. Thank you, Mr. Bunk. Next item on the agenda is introduction of Resolution 11 towards new destinations and campus climate. From Mr. Moore, do you have a presentation? You want to project the resolution?
Speak for a few minutes.
Then you're recognized for 10 minutes.
Okay. So this is a follow-up to the discussion that we had in December where the two of the university diversity officers, Dr. A.T. Miller and Dr. Renee Alexander, came and spoke to us about some of the campus climate issues like the toward new destination, campus climate surveying, and also bias response protocols. And so this resolution is a follow-up to that, and so it does a number of things. First, it says that we should do that every year. We should invite the university diversity officers to come and have a discussion with them. That discussion will be organized by the chair of the campus welfare committee, where you can discuss updates to the framework, you know, new initiatives, changes to how bias response is handled at the university level. In addition, it also says that any campus climate survey, the results need to be made public to the campus community. So in the name of openness and also trying to improve the campus climate, it's good to understand what's actually being going on. This is a firm statement that we want that to be public. Most of the other resolve clauses deal with how information about toward new destination or toward new destination is disseminated and how it's communicated. So, for example, if you are a member of the Employee Assembly or the GPSA or the Student Assembly or even this body, you want to understand what's being done in the university for all employees. There's only one place that you can go to find that, and that's on the University Diversity Council website. You have to click on a page, scroll to the bottom, click on a link, and it's in a 30-page static PDF document. Okay, so one of the resolve clauses says that this should be able, we should be able to search these items, you know, by employee or by things targeted to graduate students or students. Also, something that would be sortable by you know, topic area, so whether or not it's composition or inclusion. Being able to sort these goals would help us understand what's being done by the university and help us know how we can better help. In addition, the way that these initiatives are advertised across the university is very uneven. So for example, the College of Engineering has on their website all of their goals. They also have a poster in their building detailing their goals. Compare that to the College of Arts and Sciences, which does not have any of their goals listed or any statement regarding diversity on their website besides these are classes that you can take. They also don't have any posters or anything else. In fact, the only place where I can find the College of Arts and Sciences goals publicly is on the University Diversity Council website. So another stipulation, this resolution is saying that individual units should take ownership of these goals and initiatives and actually report them themselves and try and publicize them. I believe those are the main points. I think there's also a clause that says that every year the university diversity officers should give a report to the different constitutive assemblies detailing what the different goals and initiatives are for the upcoming year. Again, this is just to make sure that people are in the loop and that as a campus we're all involved in trying to make the campus climate better. So I will take, oh, and also, so I sent this to Drs. Miller and Alexander. They said that these all look great and that some of them they were planning to do anyway. And so they are generally in support of this. Also, the Student Assembly has passed a resolution that hits on all these points as well. So that's kind of an update on where the resolution stands.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Questions for Mr. Moore? Are there any objections to entering this resolution on the docket for a potential vote on April 22nd? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Thank you, Mr. Moore. Next item is introduction of resolution number 10, investigating open access policy for Cornell. Mr. Bunk, you going to bring up a presentation?
Yes. So just to give you guys a really quick background before we go into this presentation, the concept of creating an open access database was brought to me by Jimmy and Michelle, who I'll let them introduce themselves in a minute, and then you should ask you. And basically, through this, we met with the library board as well as members, other members of the library who run e-commerce, which we'll spend in a minute. And we've got a lot of support from them, so we thought the university assembly would be the best place to do this because this really does stand to impact all the constituencies represented here, everyone from the undergrad to the employees. So I'll actually let these guys sort of take it away from here. They've given the presentation. Dissertations is what you chose e-commerce for. And what we're hoping to do is
give the university permission through a policy to put other scholarly work on it. So right now, when you publish a paper, you transfer your copyright to the publishers, and they retain all the rights. And we're hoping to give the university rights to distribute that work in a free way. And we'll say up front that other schools are doing this as well.
So what is open access? There are a lot of different definitions of open access, but what we're talking about is essentially unrestricted access to scholarly work as opposed to an open access journal, et cetera, some of the other connotations you might have to open access. Open access is not an assault on the peer review process, and it does not mean restricting publishing at Cornell to open access journals only. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in depth. There is a worldwide movement towards open access for scientific scholarly work. And why do you care? Why would you want there to be an open access policy anywhere? First, it allows us to have a permanent repository, storage, and access to our published work. And there have been many studies now that have supported the idea that articles that are open access are cited more frequently, they're downloaded more frequently, more quickly, and so there are actual big benefits to the researcher. There are many benefits to Cornell as an institution. Again, it's an open access, an institutional repository would serve to archive our scholarly work. And at present, there are no university-wide policies or services that do this. So we have no metrics on how many papers are published by Cornell graduate students and professors each year. We know it's somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000, but we don't have an actual number. And this also allows us to be Cornell to be a leader in a global movement that's already happening. And then I got involved in this movement personally because I really believe that it's important that as a society we equalize access to knowledge and information. Most of this work is taxpayer funded, and everyone should have access to information gained through research. And in an open letter to Congress signed by 25 Nobel laureates, I love this quote, open access is the best path for accelerating multidisciplinary breakthroughs in research. So there are a lot of benefits to open access. So then we've also talked to a lot of groups that recognize that once you leave the ivory tower and you don't have access through an institution to scholarly work, you know, you just don't get the benefits of having access to these articles, and that can hinder progress.
Yeah, so Cornell has a wonderful, rich history of open access. I mean, it's written into our mission to discover, preserve, and disseminate knowledge. There is a Cornell Open Access Publication Fund that pays the publication fees that are required by open access journals if your grant won't pay it for you. So that's something great that's already here at Cornell that's actually underutilized. So that's something that we can do. Archive is a physics math preprint server that was founded by a professor who's here at Cornell and is now managed by the library. And there have been two faculty senate resolutions in the past that supported open access, but really had no teeth. There was really no action to them. So we wanted to build on this rich history that's here at Cornell.
So maybe a way to summarize what we're saying is that there's a lot of good things going on at Cornell. Open access is in our DNA. And so an example of the good things comes out every week in the Cornell Chronicle. This is a highlight that actually comes from David Holmes' research group, where this group found a new material to detect explosives. And this might be really neat to you. Maybe you're a journalist reading this article, and you try to access the article from anywhere besides Cornell or University campus, and you're met with a paywall, and you can't see the number in red, that the laser turns off. Typical access for an article if you're not associated with the university is about $35 in an article. So there's a barrier to accessing information coming from a university. And so, like we said, there's 33 universities that have recently taken this call and established policies that make work coming out of the universities freely available and through these repositories. So these are our peers, Harvard, MIT, University of California, Caltech, Princeton, and others. And so there's details of these policies that we won't get into, maybe have questions on, but they've been well thought out and vetted by these other schools, and we're hoping to adopt those policies and learn those lessons from them. So what we've done, we've started this working as a team since last fall, and did a lot of research on what these other schools have done, the nature of these policies, and kind of the legal foundation for what these policies do. We wrote an op-ed about this in the Sun. We shared the same presentation we're giving to you to department faculty meetings in the fall, and got a lot of feedback. And that feedback is part of why we're introducing the resolution that we're introducing. That's the librarians, got a lot of feedback from them. And so based on all of that feedback, we're convinced that this is a really good idea, a policy to make work openly available from Cornell. But there's a lot of details in making that happen. And what this resolution that we're hoping to introduce today to the UA is to form a committee to vet out those details. And there's a lot of questions that we put in the resolution that we would hope a committee would address. So this UA 10 would establish a committee. We wrote in a minimum list of people that we think should be on this committee. We're coming to the UA because the UA represents the entire campus community. And here, this is an issue that affects the entire campus community. Faculty, researchers, graduate student researchers, undergraduate researchers, librarians. So we thought the UA is very appropriate for this. And we wrote a list of, based on all the work that we've done so far, we wrote suggestions for questions that the community should address. And we set a date for the committee to report back next semester. With that, we'll take questions.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Are there questions for the presenters?
I have a question. You mentioned a $35 fee.
Yeah.
Who collects that fee, or do we have any information on how many times it's collected? Or
yeah. That goes as paid for the publishers, so we don't have.
So
I don't have any information. I think that's probably our job.
Mostly because you all have access to all of the there would be people who weren't affiliated with the institution that you know that we have.
Michelle has a really interesting story from when she was a private practice vet that I think illuminates why this is so important. Yes, yeah, so I'm actually an undergrad and a vet student here, and I left in 2002. Did specialty training and became a board of surgeon. I taught for a couple years and then went to private practice outside of Seattle. And more and more we're training our medical students and our veterinarians to practice evidence-based medicine, which means staying up to date with the most current research available on treating patients. But outside of a university, I have no way to access these journals. Subscriptions can range from $5,000 a year to $10,000 to $20,000 to $30,000 to $50,000 for a single journal. And so the majority of folks that are professionals or researchers outside of a major institution just simply don't have access to this published latest information. And so I actually stayed affiliated with Washington State University as an adjunct professor almost exclusively to get access through their library system to scientific journal articles. And I would estimate that somewhere between 20 to 40% of the calls I got from referring veterinarians were asking about a specific new technique or topic or research finding that they themselves didn't have access to. They were looking to me to get them these articles.
So it's easy to lose track outside of a university how critical, research data is. But that's my own personal intention.
Other questions? Ms. Bailey?
So would this change any currently existing policies like PASC for current people affiliated with universities?
Not at all. And so this resolution, so they could start asking what the policy is. This resolution, this committee said the policy should go forward and vote on it. The policy is implemented. It wouldn't affect anybody at the university in terms of their access at all. It would help people outside the university.
But actually, if you were at your own home, you wouldn't have to log into Cornell necessarily. You wouldn't have to have a university ID to gain access to Cornell's published work.
Wait, so follow-up, sorry. But I would still need the PASC in order to access publications that were not through Cornell.
That were not.
Other questions, Mr. McGrath?
So if you can kind of give the publisher's perspective, how is it maybe could it affect the publisher's business paradigm, and even possibly if there could be argument that we could go full circle and possibly even hinder research efforts?
That's a great question. You hit on the head. So as you can imagine, publishers would be really the only people against such a policy. There's for-profit publishers and there's non-profit publishers. The for-profit are a lot very against it. The non-profits are seem to be kind of neutral. So the nonprofit would be like a professional. The neat thing about this is that 33 schools have done this, have implemented these policies already. It's only been going on since about 2009, so it's still pretty fresh. That it hasn't broken the bank on any publishers, and nor has it affected the university facilities published in those terms. So one of the details of these policies that would opt out and clauses that if a publisher says we don't take this policy, you can still opt out and publish it as a faculty researcher. So there's definitely a give and take, and the nature of publishing is certainly evolving. And this is one of those. This is one step in that evolution. That's a great question.
And we look at it a bit like the paradigm of the NIH. If you get money from the NIH to do research, you have to publish your. You have to put your articles on PubMed or else you will no longer get funded by the NIH. And so that's mandatory now.
That affects a lot more publications than this market when I was.
Okay. Sort of makes
difference. Other questions? Thank you. I request the Assembly's unanimous consent to enter UA Resolution 10 onto the docket for April 22nd and put it out for public comment. Any objections? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Thank you. And a sidebar, Joe Burns, would I appreciate especially the faculty senate's view since you've apparently in 2003 and 2005 delved in this and that didn't pan out. So things probably changed, but want to make sure we know what the faculty senate's perspective is. Thank you, sir. Mr. Howe, is Ben still in route, or would you like to? Then I ask members unanimous consent to amend the orders of the day and to move to the TCAT resolution because we have guests here that don't have other business before the assembly. Are there any objections? Hearing none, then Mr. Ruiz Calderon, would you please introduce TCAT Resolution 14? Could you speak a little louder, please?
All right. Just to give everyone a little context, the deficit was presented to us on January 28th on deficit towards the TCAT. There was a large lack of funding. I hope everyone has. Yeah. Just to give everyone a rundown as to what happened and the information that we have at hand. Well, let's tell you the truth, we don't really want for this resolution or for these results to occur. We don't want to eliminate some three first year passes, but given the circumstances that we have, this is really the only viable solution that we came up with and that was thrown at us and that we saw as actually make an impact to continue to teach and continue having it running. So just a rundown on the financial statement. You can see as of 2006 is what the free first-year pass is introduced, we were receiving subsidies at an equal base amount. Cornell, CDL was receiving subsidies from Cornell, Ithaca, and State of New York, where it was about a dollar a ride. That's what it needs to break even. It needs to be made at a dollar a ride. In 2000, this was only meant, the free first-year pass was only meant to last until 2008. And you can already see that when the dollar ride happened, the paid rides drastically decreased, and after 2008 it was mostly canceled due to a research paper that was done. It was only meant to be a two-year project. It never came up to attendance, never came up to anyone's recognition, and then we just continued having it, although it should have been addressed right there and then. As you can see, this is the number of riders we have for a dollar ride. We're easily reaching over 3 million people, although we're addressing the CU paid fare a little bit over 2,500,000 people.
Dollars?
Dollars. Well, dollars people.
Wow.
Yeah. Then this one's kind of elaborated. A lot of you can see the bigger picture.
Right.
These rides are subsidized in green. The total ride subsidized. And you can see this is what university students are paying for. The funding that we're receiving from Cornell, it's been a flat rate since 2006. And the problem has occurred that the number of students that are being subsidized increasing. So what happened is now students, instead of being subsidized dollar for dollar, which would allow TCAT to continue to profit or just to continue to work as it is, it's created a deficit now where now TCAT is running 86 cents per ride. And the reason is because now with the same amount of money, we're subsidizing more students, and more students are giving these rides. And given the data, there's a lot of data to prove this. Easiest one, the clearest one to show that it's really based off the freshmen who are creating this demand, the largest increase, is that the OmniPass rides for sophomores have not really increased. This is a change in increases. However, since 2006, when it was presented, you can see a large fluctuation. And this pretty much caused a $700,000 annual deficit. The annual deficit is not something that we can do one time, one fix, and then we can create a deficit again and then do a one time, one fix. It has to be something that can make it sustainable again. So given the past, given the amount, and it was already been proposed, and I think this came to my attention that from the beginning of this presentation, or from the beginning that this was ever given to us, that Cornell had decided not to subsidize or increase the subsidy. So given that nature, given that context, we work within those bounds. We're not trying to create a new solution. We're trying to create feasible solution within that. So we had many options, and we had many requests, such as first eliminating, at least giving it free for half a semester. That option was not viable. It didn't increase income. There are the options of increasing the OmniPass rides. The OmniPass rides, you can see, aren't really that popular. Students are using them, and it's slightly increased, but it's not really, it really wouldn't do enough to impact the health of the users. And then if you do it that way, the burden is really based off this very small threshold and a very small portion of the campus who buys the OmniPass ride, and you're putting on the burden of them to pay for these subsidies. So running now down the resolution, there's obviously everyone can ask questions afterwards, but given the number of meetings we've had with Mr. David Howe, with Kelly Page, and Mr. Benzo, we've drive, and they've given us many financial numbers, which I don't even necessarily show because they'll make it a very long presentation, because that is the gist of it, and I'm sure they'll have you answer any logistics, but the resolution goes as the first lines, the first whereas would be if subsidies don't increase, and we made it clear that we would like subsidies, or ideally we wouldn't want to, which is clear within the resolution, which is the way when it starts off by saying, if subsidies do not increase, if support doesn't increase the subsidies, from the 86 rides, from the 80, right now it seems 86 cents, if it doesn't increase again to a dollar, creating this $700,000 deficit, first year students will pretty much have to lose this privilege. They're the ones primarily causing it, so if you can't increase that subsidy, unfortunately, given the circumstances, that's what has to occur. We can continue reading. There's been another resolution, another proposal given through SA that we're willing to sponsor, which says we're allowed to use your Cornell card, which hoping that would increase income. But the big problem here is to increase income. Not necessarily to find a way, a tricky maneuver solution around it, is how can we increase income to to offset this subsidy disparity, or offset the disparity in increased prices. If anyone has questions, please feel free to ask. The resolution is really quite simple. It does say that it pretty much addresses that we can increase our subsidies, we will have to eliminate first-year passes.
Mr. Bonk, are you able to put the resolution as currently drafted on the screen? Questions for Mr. Ruiz Calderon or our guests who can maybe assist with some of the technical details?
I have a question.
Ms. Chapman?
So, by eliminating the free pass, is there a, what do they hope to gain by how many people would then buy a pass? Like, is there any way to.
It's not that the students will now pay for the pass. And if a student pays for it now, you're automatically going to the break-even mode.
Well, but you're assuming that just because they had it for free before, that now they're going to pay for it, which that's what I'm
going to do. Do the sensitivity analysis. George asked us to do a sensitivity analysis to try to determine what we need to get the break-even. And so if we assume that the same rate people were currently bypassing on campus, which is about a little over 30% of people bypassing, if we apply that rate to the first year students, we think that was covered. So we're assuming based on past data that a certain population of people are buying passes, the same percentage of the population of passes are currently pursued and probably purchased. And we also think the first year students will be cold, depending on how you're late in the game at marketing. But we also think that the first year students, by nature, where they're housed, they might buy more.
I can, just to sort of follow up on what Dave was saying, in terms of marketing to the first-year students, it's if the expectation is, much like a meal plan, that students have to purchase something, all of their classes will be not on North Campus, they'll just have to get there, that the parents are more likely to make sure that their children have these passes as well. So it's both direct marketing to students, but also making it part of the first-year packaging of information that would be necessary.
Thank you. Sure. If I can just comment something, something that George didn't say, but I think is relevant, is we still are subsidizing passes. So if a student is going to buy a pass at TCAT, it costs $600, whereas the pass that we're selling the students is $200.
Yes.
So the value is still significant.
So,
yes,
and maybe this is already covered, I apologize, but why was it introduced to begin with, the free pass? What was the lead up to that?
There was a commitment.
There's a commitment to do a transportation planning study between the town and the university. It's called TDICE.
Mm-hmm.
That program, the proposal for it started in about 2005 or so. They published it in 2008. So based on that commitment, the commitment is actually over for one of the Cornell programs that was introduced, or why it was introduced. So really, technically since 2008, standpoint of making sure that planning study was done first had already been done. So that was the creation of that new program.
Mr. Ruiz Calderon, you're thinking, Ms. Schaffner, Mr. Moore?
Yes, I have two questions. One's real quick, just for the record. This won't affect the free nights and weekends.
No, that was one of the options. We kept it there's a safety issue there that we don't want to entertain.
Okay. And then the second issue I have a question of is, as a graduate professional representative, so this affects the graduate students, was any feasibility study done on steps like ending the first year pass for undergraduate students but keeping it for graduate students?
No. We did not. Right now we don't differentiate in that pass for students. We differentiate obviously between a student and employee. That pass is we don't differentiate between grad and undergrad. So we do not look at separating them.
One of the principles we looked at too in going in this direction was equity. And this will be the same cost for everybody across the board, depending on regardless of what type of student you are.
So it's probably the student on the path to the student on the
I bring that up just because there really isn't any graduate student housing, and so most graduate students do not live in college town or around the university.
Right. I think when we look at $200 from a transit pass, though, it prevents a and the whole point of this, and you know, we really talked to the president, is the concept of transportation demand management, is really giving choices and really incentives, right, for folks to look at alternative ways other than owning a car, bringing a car, and having to drive it back and forth. I don't think anyone's going to be able to look at $200 of owning a car and having a year's debt to campus as being economically viable. So I think, again, while, yes, most graduate students live afar, we believe that, at least in the county, the network is enough that hopefully it will provide enough alternatives for folks to be able to have to be involved in campus to do that. It is a very economically enticing arena to look at. Hey, I might choose this house because it's closer to that bus line and mm-hmm. enables me not to have to park and not have to drive. And that's kind of part of this kind of tug of war of trying to create this enticement for people to use campus.
Ms. Bailey? Sorry, didn't know it
was bite. So I was just wondering, my understanding is that the you to get 100% landlord will get the trans pass covered. I mean, students who will be able to afford the pass and be able to afford the pass. But what about the students in the middle who can't necessarily afford that $200? Do you think there's going to be a pretty socioeconomic divide between, you know, the middle class students and the students who can afford to pay money for the pass, and like, don't you think that would negatively impact the freshman experience?
I would say that you this is like a really a financial decision. As much as I would like as an undergraduate representative not want to see it happen, this is really a financial decision based on the money we have. So it's looking at via numerous amount of solutions, we've had these conversations. That's kind of why I thought Joe was in my head, because I've read so many different solutions that you've been in one of the meetings as well. It's hard to address it, but this is really just keeping the company afloat. So
I think this is not exact to deal with it, but if we go back to 2005 and look at the data that we have, the purchase of student passes at that rate in 2005 is at least double. So, and that's both on the overall as well as on the sophomore purchase. So, yes, there's an effect. I think it would be different if we said that you never pay for a student pass ever for that 4 years and now all of a sudden you have to pay for it. Because I think that decision is going to have to be made anyway by the second year, regardless of whether we change the program or not. So, again, I think the data that we showed before was that we do believe that it's at an affordable rate and that it's, again, compared to owning a car and having to manage a car here on site, I think it's not even close to being the same, you know, dollar here to do that. So, yeah, the $200 is going to be difficult for some students.
I think that there is, in instance, a socioeconomic problem. Pre-nice weekends, many ways to help. There was errands or shopping, things like that, people had to get done downtown. That option is going to still be there. They need the convenience to take in, you know, be one of those bridges. Goes away, but I think the real needy people, things people need transportation for, so really they're not taking that away.
And the $1.50, right? So if we go the ability to have easier, which actually was just a great, I mean, we weren't even thinking of that, we're always focused on PATH, the ability for getting that feedback from the American grad, from SA to say, hey, what about creating this pay by the ride to make it easier on my ID? Because now it's $1.50, and you can kind of choose when you need or not to use that. So I think that does provide another kind of economic alternative, the ability for people to use transit in a way that's specific. But maybe it's only one thing.
Let me interrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, we're ahead of schedule for the meeting, but at time for this item. So I ask for unanimous consent to extend this discussion another 10 minutes and recognize Mr. Smith.
I just want to clarify on the financial aid thing. It's not, financial aid doesn't, it won't restrict people from getting the pass. Everybody can get the pass covered via a budget increase. The budget increase is in the form of a loan. It's not for anybody. It's not a cost factor for the faculty experience. So, it's not a line item in your system. So that's not, for even those who are on full financial aid, they don't necessarily plan to be right. It comes in certain forms, but that just depends on what happens. If you're a student who's ineligible for financial aid because you are in that bracket that is above, you know, that percentage, the way they do financial aid packaging is based on whether you get any grants or scholarships, or they cap the amount of loans that you're actually eligible for. So those who are in that higher bracket are eligible for a much higher loan maximum because they pay it back. access. So it's a $200 budget increase that you file with the Office of Financial Aid Students for undergraduates. I don't know how it is for graduate students. So let me just disclaimer. So you file that, you just get that back at first our complete coverage. But you'll end up paying that back kind of like later on.
Okay.
I bought one for 5 years. So just kind of
thank you, Mr. Smith. Ms. Lucas-Eiberts?
So I just had a quick question. Did you guys look at a study to see if there it was possible to get freshmen maybe 5, 10, 15 free rides for emergencies or so that the first week they're on campus they can figure out their way around? I was wondering if you guys had looked into that at all as a way to just like compensate for this week.
I did propose something for giving them the first 2 weeks. You can mention on the financial burden. I know the transition would be difficult, the notification way would be difficult. Then how do they, it's not linked to the Cornell card anymore. So when they start, they would have to change.
It's a good idea. We did have a discussion with CIC. I think that it's complicated just turning on and off and giving the ride and how long does it last. And it just is not even I think the alternative, again, is a very good alternative, is the ability to pay by the ride.
Right, and if you pay by the ride, would it be possible for Cornell to give each student 5 rides on their Cornell card, like paid for, at the beginning of their time as like a freshman or whatever? And that just be paid for in the same system that would be paid for the ride and you put in the money or whatever through whatever website?
I think it's a question of funding. So where does this money come from? Because again, you know, the other thing, I'm sorry I was late, but this conversation of transit and being highly subsidized, that's just money that, you know, he gets either not getting it or getting most of the money to give it to him.
So that was my question, was whether it would be affordable for us to give maybe even just one.
It's hard to project what impact this is going to have on our ridership and our actual costs. So one of the things the resolution says is asks us to come back to the infrastructure committee to discuss funding on an annual basis. So this being our first cut out, we did a whole bunch of sensitivity analysis. We have an idea based on current ridership rules would be, but there's always unintended consequences of these types of things. And I think it's better for us to see a year of data before we understand that. And this isn't a cash cow. So if we have more revenue, we can help keep that. We'll be able to make some kind of solution like you're suggesting maybe in the future.
Most of the ridership. So if I'm a Cornell freshman, we're not coming up 3 nights a week. What's my typical
That's a good question because we did some Instagram. And the majority of the people who get the free pass a distinct majority, use the ride to pass less than once or twice a week. So it's not.
And where do they go?
That we can't really track because we can track when you get on the bus.
But you can't track when you're out, right?
But you're not quite
on the route.
Yeah.
So what is the most popular route?
Clearly, 8281 or high frequency routes.
So basically, they're coming to campus.
Yeah.
Right.
So
you go to the mall. The mall is a big
thing. Okay, the mall is the other thing as well. So in a way, there may be other ways that, for instance, the mall ride is very popular, right? I mean, it could be, for instance, some bus companies have like preferred routes, but you get a preferred route, but the cost is more. I mean, is it possible to go to?
So all those are possible. I think the underlying question at the end of the day is equity for supporting PCAP as a company. So I'm going to, you know, what I would suggest is you're going to see in the next year, you're going to see Tioga, Chemung, and Cortland, those transit companies, possibly going to have this.
Yeah.
Right? So I think some of you have seen in the news, if you live in those areas, you see the struggles that they're going through. So at the end of the day, it still comes down to, are we as a community going to support PCAP? Right? And that's what PCAP board members are here to talk about is that they're overburdened, the system is at its max. They don't have the ability to increase their capital without having to go out to grants. So they're struggling financially. So, it's always a question of can you give free and negotiate, but that's where we got from where we are, where we're not getting that dollar for ride.
We're getting a lot of pressure from the county specifically, not as much from the city about, you know, if you tell us the increase in ridership by for PCAP,
So there are multiple ways you could actually subsidize to trust on the transfer. One is because the university pay for it, but what's the possibility that the students could do it for the students? And if this is important for it, so you actually put it as part of the student activity. If this is a critical feature for our first year students in terms of their introduction to the community, is it possible for the students to actually
No. I would say like that is on. I said that would be part of the marketing team. I suggested that as well, but I don't think it should be something that you should force them to be charged on, because some students will bring their card. It's almost like a gym membership. Where it's part of your membership. If it's a student that you choose to have as a student that you leave me, and then we brought up.
What aren't the physical fitness centers that come out all students that are at the university? Even though all students don't use them.
Well, this would be part of your subsidized to a dollar ride. Or $1.50 that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just pass this.
So the Omni ride is pretty
much. To frame it, the day we're going to talk about it. If you were to take away all subsidies, and TCAT was to be a just regular for profit business, the ride price would be $6.
Okay.
So to put it in context, that at $1.50 and $1 ride, there's already a very high subsidy. So all we're talking about is actually not funding TCAT anymore. We talk about the free ride. That's really the pressure that's there. None of this money is going to transportation facilities. None of the revenue at all.
One of the things in the resolution says $700,000, and $200,000 of that is not really a visiting impact. We're newly having to pay on our campus bus. We recently got approval to raise the prices for external users of that bus, not formal community members, to capture that cost. So we think the $700,000 now is probably high. We think the deficit is going to be more around 500,000, which,
We need to wind this down, Mr. Bunk, and then I think Ms. Shapner, and we may have a member of the public who has a question.
Yes. I guess I had one clarifying question. So, I mean, it's obviously pretty hard to predict the future. So if this passes and pay this bond and this system is really messed up, how hard does this change to undo? And then I guess my second question is, again, sort of, I guess you guys don't predict the situation, but say you guys remove the free bus pass and there's zero riders. In sort of that extreme situation. Obviously, that's not going to happen. What would you do in that sort of extreme situation? Cut routes or like new routes?
That's kind of, it's kind of difficult for us to do all of that. So I do know that TCAT is wholly separate. We act as a partner, and there are board members, and we act as a funding partner on the city county. Their service manager is kind of rethinking their service and their routes. That would be really, again, TCAT is a separate entity, thinking how the impact of the routes would be if that could happen. And, again, I think what we've asked is to think about before this program was introduced in 2005, that's probably a viable number to think about in terms of if it does reduce ridership, if it does adjust what the path focus is for TCAT to rethink their business based on the 2005, what the impact would be in that.
And then I guess, if this goes in, could this body sort of reverse this change next year easily?
I mean, to go back and forth, I think there's this ability to kind of turn it back on and off. In fact, actually, we have to do a lot of things. It's funny because it actually is a lot of work to get that free pass. There's a lot of internal systems, both through database as well as TCAT and our side, to actually figure out who's new to Cornell. And so that's there. We would actually be reducing that process by not doing that, we streamlining the business in the student path. So it would be a matter of putting that back in the place rather than having to change something different.
Thank you. Ms. Shapner?
When this proposed change makes the ridership go for them, how does that affect the state funding that we receive?
So the state does go up to the state funded, and the state funded 40 cents a ride. So the ridership goes down, they would be impacted.
I'm sorry, so you're currently receiving 40 cents a ride?
Right. TCAT receives 40 cents a ride. It's part of that $6 overall.
And there's no distinction between who's riding for free or discounted riding and who's paying 40 cents. So that's going to change.
Absolutely. I highlighted that to TCAT Budget Committee. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we thought we had a creative solution to avoid this a couple weeks ago, but
you didn't seem to be able to get to a dollar per ride based on that. You were trying to avoid losing the 40 cents, but that wasn't, we wouldn't have to take there to take that risk. We wanted to increase our funding.
So in the line 8 of whereas TCAT is receiving an average of 86 cents per ride, that's what they're receiving from Cornell.
Correct.
And then in addition to that, they receive an additional 40 cents per ride in the state.
So the easy way to kind of look at it is that between the city, county, and Cornell each contribute 10%, or roughly 30% of their operating budget. Another 40% of their operating budget comes to the state. It changes back and forth depending on what the ridership and whatever. But roughly right there, 70% of it has nothing to do with how many, with the actual fare that's being paid. It's straight off the top subsidy.
There was one member of the public who maybe had a question.
Hi everyone. I'm Lee Schechter. I'm a sophomore undergrad. I actually have a lot of things to say about this, but it's been too long. I don't have too much time. But my main question was, I know that President Gordon has resisted giving a lot, or funding a lot of different projects, especially that public health. Was there anything to give a specific reason as to why they're not?
Because
it seems like there's a lot of, there's no more subsidies, but what's the
procedure
for it?
So, the Cornell general and the money? I think to the thought of not increasing subsidies remain at the level, mm-hmm. It's just not enough. I think the competing priority is that people make decisions on. I think they have an appetite to spend a certain amount of money on transportation. That's the level we're at.
I can add a little light on that based on our diversity discussions, which is a separate issue heading towards the assembly. The Cornell has an endowment. It's a $5 billion endowment, but they live off of, so 20%, 20 or something, 20% or 30% of our annual operating costs come from the interest on that endowment. And at the moment, President Gordon's predicting that after running at $2.08 billion for just 1 year, that's that we're going to have about a $2 million surplus if we're lucky at the end of the year. So why are they not anxious to increase this subsidy and others? Because he called it in a previous meeting in a different, slightly different context, a potential rounding error. $2 million on a $2.08 billion budget annually is potentially rounding error. And they do not want to sell funds that are in the endowment. They want the interest from those funds in the endowment to pay this 20% slice. So it sounds like Cornell has a lot of money, and at one level they do, but they can't eat into the endowment, and your return on investments is a little bit different each year. We've had our lean years. Hopefully the next years will be good. I think if over time the endowment pays out more and more because interest rates are better, they'll have better reserves, and they could consider upping the subsidy. But right now the answer is a clear no to facility services, which is why they said, okay, we've got a tough nut to crack. Of the things we can think of and anything you can think of, what's the best of the worst scenarios, meaning it's going to cost a little bit more for classes of ridership?
I think context, too. So we have a total amount.
Yeah, no, it's close to $4 million annually.
So it's not that we're not supporting. We're highly supporting the act.
To go along with your endowment comment, I know that Cornell's tuition is increasing by almost $2,000, which is going to give them, with 14,000 undergrads, about $27 million. So this shows that Cornell is not completely funded on endowment?
No, only 20%. And President Scorton is concerned that he cannot raise tuition any more but as a percentage. It's a whole different discussion that we can't get into here. Mm-hmm. But it is well thought out. I know it's not happy news. It's well thought out, and I'd be glad to discuss it a little further as I am able to, and I'm not the expert by any means, after the meeting. But we need to bring this item to close. So one final comment from Gina?
I was just going to say, this is going back to a model that had been in place not too long ago. So the first year free is not something that has just been going on and we're stopping it because it's at this point in time. It's been just since 2005, and as all the data was showing, ridership has just increased. It did what it was meant to do, but now we just can't afford to keep it there without finding a way to bridge that gap. But I think the historic perspective is very important because it's not something that everybody always had.
And the unintended consequences that TCAT actually was getting less funding from RIDE. That's, again, the tug of war is that this is really about funding a community system and doing it in an equitable and fair fashion to make sure that it does survive.
Thank you. Our time on this needs to end. I request unanimous consent from members to enter this into UA Resolution Number 14, post it for public comment, and bring it up for potential vote at our meeting on April 22nd. Are there any objections? So during the public comment period, if there are changes in facts or I know you have some potential friendly resolutions on making some wording that's non-consequential a little clearer, we would be glad to accept that at our April 22nd meeting. Certainly, we want to get this as correct as possible in whatever action we take, and that would be the meeting to do that. Any objections? Then it is so ordered. The next item on the agenda is introduction of Resolution Number 12 regarding rights of complainants for summary decisions. Mr. Meese, you're recognized for 10 minutes, and thank you, presenters.
Yeah, we
really appreciate your time and coming and spending it with us.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. So hopefully I don't have to take a whole 10 minutes, because it's just sort of a revisit and a cleanup from a resolution that was passed last year by the assemblies, by the university assembly in terms of president. The president sent it back for some clarification. The points that he and both council asked for clarification on were in section 5 of this. But essentially, for those of you who weren't here last year, I'll give you sort of a broad overview of what this is. And any members of the CJC, if you'd like to chime in at any time, by all means, I'm happy to share. So this was this came out of both the Judicial Codes Counselor, which are the law school students who aid the accused students in sort of navigating their rights through the system and helping them in whatever way that they need within the confines of their job description, and the JA's office. A lot of it really comes down to the procedural issues with the JA's office and how they manage their workflow, and taking the code and aligning it with what their practice has been, will continue to be, and is sort of a best practice standpoint. So a lot of it was, Mary Beth prompting, hey, can we make some of these changes so that the code reflects what actually is going on and the process in which we've done. Some of the things that it does is it extends some time limits from 2 days to 5 days, so students, and that's business days, so folks can be notified and have time to respond. The whole idea here is that it's about a summary decision agreement, or an SDA, which is essentially the judicial administrator's ability to say, okay, you were brought up on charges of X. Instead of having a hearing and review board and the process, 10 hours of community service, a letter from X, Y, and Z saying that you completed that, and here's our agreement. They have a period of time to accept that as the accused party, and then a notification of the accepting of the summary decision agreement is sent to the complainant. The complainant then also has a period of time to either accept that or challenge that and say, hey, wait, no, listen, they stole my purse, they pushed me in the mud, and they were drunk while doing it, and this is not okay. 10 hours of community service is not going to work, and this is crazy. So then it gets sent to the chair of the hearing and review board for review and certain things. And the last part of that, when it gets sent to the chair of the hearing review board, the one piece we added was that the board can uphold the decision of the judicial administrator in whole or in part. So there's that in part, because it didn't give them that to say, well, we like the 10 hours of community service, but we also want you to do, you know, X, Y, and Z on top of that. So that's added. But the part that's really changed, which I'll now highlight, is, and where the president took issue, and so did counsel's office, was the right for a university complaint.
What line?
Pardon?
What line?
So it essentially starts at 71. A university complainant would be University Audit Office, the Dean of Students Office, Cornell entity that's a recognized, you know, business function aspect sort of thing. And what they did was we essentially proposed originally to not have a right to appeal a summary decision agreement by a university complaint. But what we did here was we said that we would notify folks in certain instances, and this is sort of what's changed from the previous resolution. For a university complaint, the judicial administrator need notify the complaint only a case where the university complaint submitted a written request for notification at the time the complaint is lodged, and in specific cases, limited to cases involving any violence or threatened violence against another person, violations of the financial irregularities policy, and fraud or theft against the university in the amount exceeding $100. So what this does is it students steal the banana and an orange from a dining hall. Dining hall manager finds this student, says you're in violation of the code, you stole, you know, 72 cents and 85 cents, so they're a little bit under $2. They can, if the judicial administrator says, listen, you need to pay for that, you need to do some community service, that's in our summary decision agreement, you've signed off on that, I mean, the dining hall can't go back and say, no, that's not fair, you know, it was only $2. And also what it does is it has a procedural aspect for the judicial administrator where they don't have to notify because they get a lot of those under that threshold case limit. So they're sending out, or they would need to send out, a lot of notifications for things that would never really be challenged. So it sets some specific instances in which notification is required. And both counsel's office and the judicial administrator worked over months to come up with that section there, and that's really what's new to this resolution.
Questions from Mr. Measy? I request unanimous consent to waive reading of the resolution into the minutes. Are there any objections? Hearing none, and I make that same request for any other one that I didn't formally make that request because my parliamentary procedure may have been lacking. Hearing no questions from Mr. Measy, I request unanimous consent to designate this UA Resolution Number 12, put it on the docket for April 22nd, and put it out for public comment. Any objections? Hearing none. Next on the agenda.
There's not going to be. Are there going to be other objections? Because I'd rather get an understand question. Sorry, Jim. I'd rather get those questions out of the way in advance, so I'm prepared to answer those at their next meeting. So if there is anything comes up in your mind before that time, please feel free to email me. I'm happy to have Mary Beth at counsel's office clarify those. But I know we're moving through.
Mr. Measy does not like,
I don't want to get
point of impact questions. As you can see, it's a very complex resolution. They've looked at it long and hard. So if you do have questions or concerns, let him know in advance so he can actually answer your question and or tell you the rationale instead of having to think on his feet. On April 22nd. Next item, update, introduction of Resolution 13 regarding Code and Policy 6.4 alignment. Mr. Measy.
So the biggest piece of this here is basically in line 11, the whereas the University Assembly passed Resolution 7 back in 2012, which approved President Scorton, and this resolution directed the Cornell University Policy 6.4 be amended, and that the allegations of sexual violence and sexual harassment be evolved through said policy until such time as the campus code of conduct is amended to fulfill the requirements of Title IX. So what it's changing here is really sort of the footnote in the code and in certain spots where it changes some of the language, which you can see the italicized to offenses involving sexual violence and sexual harassment while still violations of the campus code of conduct will be investigated and adjudicated under Cornell University Policy 6.4 until such time as the code is amended to fulfill the requirements. Title IX. So, and then the second page, line 40 to 41, say where the footnotes referring to this appendix will be inserted. It really is just sort of to clean that up, and it's a much more comprehensive code change to bring the code in alignment with this. Which Mary Beth is working on, but won't be something that this group in its current makeup will have the opportunity to see.
Questions for Mr. Measy on Potential Resolution 13? Hearing none, then I again ask unanimous consent to waive reading of the resolution into the minutes. I further ask unanimous consent to accept UA Resolution 13, post it for public comment, and place it on the docket for discussion and potential vote on April 22nd. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered. The next item on the agenda is for me to update the assembly on the Faculty Senate resolution on carbon neutrality and divestment. So at a previous meeting, we decided to look up at the Faculty Senate, and the Faculty Senate forwarded the resolution to us to see if we wanted to join into its precepts. You were interested in looking at it. I have been able to set up on April 8th, one of our optional meeting dates. Professor Shabbat cannot attend. He is the, I consider, the principal introducer of the initial legislation or resolution of the Faculty Senate. But he is his co, I don't know what you call him, co-resolution sponsor, and others are available, and he has recommended them. He is okay if we proceed, and he has recommended Dan Roth, sustainability coordinator, who covered the importance of achieving climate neutrality in Cornell's Climate Action Plan, Jeff Bergfault, graduate student in mathematics, to describe why divestment is part of the resolution, David Shalloway, professor, to describe the financial consequences of the divestment. We will also have a person from facilities talk to us about what are the implications of this and what it would mean for them, so that you understand the impacts. And I have a commitment from Joanne DeStefano and A.J. Edwards to join the meeting, and presumably, I don't want to put words in their mouth, why they perhaps are not in favor of the divestment piece of the Faculty Senate's resolution. With that information in your available to you, then the question will be, do you want to sponsor a resolution, you know, that in support of the Faculty Senate's resolution? Do you want to divide the options, carbon neutrality and divestment? Do you want to throw the whole thing away? Do you want to remain silent on it after hearing all the discussion? So the purpose of the April 8th meeting, this is really the only thing on the docket at the moment, with one exception, which I'll cover in a moment, which is a 30-second issue. I'm going to tee it up. The people who want it and are passionate about it, the people who are not so certain, and the people who are dead set against it. You're going to hear them all on April 8th, and then you need to tell me what type of resolution you want, if any. I will make it happen. We will publish it, and it will give you a chance to vote on it before we turn into pumpkins May 7th. So that is the plan, and that is the update. Questions for me?
So do we have to enter in every resolution into this waiting period, or is that just a practice that we've adopted?
There are certain types of things that we do that do not require a full 30 days of public notice, but in general, if it's going to affect the community and we're making decisions, so we can do a sense of the University Assembly resolution, which does not carry necessarily the full weight of a vetted 30-day public comment, okay? Then yes, we can, as members, waive our internal procedures of 30 days. In other words, we agree or disagree with the university faculty resolution is probably something we don't have to post. If we're going to say we think we should do this with divestment, I would tell you that it needs to be for public comment, because we would need to hear testimony and counter-testimony from experts that are generally not in this room. So it really...
I guess my question is given to, could we have a sense of body,
yes,
teed up at the end of that conversation?
I have some drafts already in my kit that I have not circulated yet, because I don't really like them yet, and I don't know where you want to go, because after every meeting I get, we need to do this, and, you know, diametrically opposed, we need to do this. And you're representatives from other assemblies that have passed various resolutions, several of you, so there's also your view versus your constituent body's view, so it becomes very complex. I know what I think should be done, but I need to hear from you before I put out my recommendations as to what you would want to be done. That's how I would prefer to approach it. First, I want you to hear all sides, because it's especially in the divestment, it's been unclear whether the other assemblies have had somebody going who said no, and here's why no, versus just no. you know, so I want that here. You will believe it or not. You will value it as you see fit. But I want that, I want to ensure that you've heard that before you vote on at least that half of the resolution. Certainly the other part too. So that's the plan. That's the plan. Any other questions about that plan? Then no, that's the old business. Now, the reason that the reports of the assemblies follow the old business is because that was a continuation of the last meeting. So Robert's Rules tells us how we're supposed to do that. We finish that meeting before we start this one. So now we're up to reports. Does the student assembly have anything they wish to report?
Yeah, I'm going to do it for you. We passed our resolution of DUA's R11, the 14 destinations resolution, last week. It was resolution 63. We also passed a resolution creating a judicial commission underneath the student assembly, and we'll be hearing a short amendment at the request of the university council this Thursday. We'll also be hearing a resolution regarding our endowment on Thursday. And last but not least, we're hosting a Cornell Care and Community event on Wednesday at 9 p.m. in front of the Schwartz Center called Breaking the Silence. We're asking students as well as staff and administrators to come together and create a constructive dialogue around sexual violence and bias at Cornell. It's a great opportunity to share resources that our community has, and you know, President Ford and Susan Murphy and some of the trustees will be in attendance and speaking.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Bailey?
Could you just circulate that maybe to the other assemblies, or I don't know if that's something that the office can help you with, just so we can get that out to our respective listserv?
Sure.
Yeah.
You send me your report and I'll send it around.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Bunk for the GPSA.
So I think one event we had was our annual Dine and Discuss, where we discussed issues of workers' compensation for graduate students. The main reason being there was a student injured in chemical engineering recently, and sort of it became very apparent that, A, his advisor stopped funding him because he couldn't do research, but B, there's sort of no, in a sense, safety net or even clarification as to what should happen in these situations. And we used that as an opportunity to discuss that. The second thing that we talked about last night at our meeting is the administration has decided to increase the pay rate of teaching assistants, but not research assistants. Unfortunately, we were really disappointed in the fact that they essentially consulted no graduate students in this process. So there was a little bit of executive board. For example, Monet was consulted, and they were asked to sort of sign on to it on behalf of it. They refused, and this was pushed through anyway. As you may know, Derek, our trustee, voted against the budget for this reason, one of the first people to do so in recent memory. And so now we're trying to work out a way to move forward from here. Whether or not you agree or disagree with the merits of differential pay rates, a bigger issue is that we weren't consulted on an issue that is really important to graduate students. And so we're hoping that we can move forward from here with that.
Questions for Mr. Bunk? Ms. Schaffner, Employee Assembly.
Thank you. We also had a presentation on the carbon neutrality and divestment strategy a couple of meetings ago, and we are waiting to hear more from the other side, and could we invite EA members to come to the April 8th meeting?
Oh, absolutely.
Very good. That would be a good time for them to come. We voted in a new member, Marie DeRoos, so we're now fully slated, so that's great. The Mary Opperman Award for Staff Advocacy will be open for nominations soon, so staff members could look out for that. Anxious to get nominations in. And also the George Peter Award is also taking in nominations. Both of those awards will be up on our website soon. George Peter is already there. Mary Opperman Award will be posted soon. And the EA is looking forward to meeting with the Board of Trustees tomorrow for a reception and nice conversation.
Excellent. Questions for Ms. Schaffner? And let me clarify, that April 8th meeting, it's open to the public. but it is not necessarily an open mic for or against the issues. It's to educate all of us. And so hopefully we won't, I mean, if there are a few people and they, you know, and everybody's reasonable and calm, we would certainly like everybody to participate in the discussion. But if 40 people come, let's just make sure the right expectations are there and the banners are off this.
Can I add one comment?
Yes, ma'am.
So, Derek did have a nice article in the Chronicle. I don't know if people caught it or not, but if you didn't, it is a really good article on the divestment issue. So I would advise you to look for that.
Thank you. Faculty Senate, Dean Burns.
We had a long conversation with the president at our last meeting, and topics there where he had just announced that he was leaving the university, and so what's going to happen in the next 15 months came up. The big topics still are divestment and Hope Plaza type things. The committees that we have operating right now, or the Educational Policy Committee, has been hearing a lot, and I've been hearing a lot about complaints about the calendar and about the final schedule for final exams, and that has been discussed. We have proposals in front of CAPS, the Academic Freedom and Professional Status, for new titles for professors, professor of the practice, which would be sort of to bring in experts, but not given the standard tenure line, and for a research professor, and they will be discussed later in this week and maybe on the agenda of the next Faculty Senate meeting. The Financial Policies Committee has had discussions with the provost, and the provost is now, for the first time in many years, putting faculty members on budget planning committees to, since we do some of the work around here, we should probably, and also to ask about, I guess he's now allowing myself and the chair of that committee, plus an expert on faculty compensation, to look at, have open books as to what people get paid. And then we will prepare a report, which presumably will be a template for an annual report on how Cornell is behaving in terms of faculty salaries.
Thank you, Dean Burns. Questions for the dean? Hearing none, moving to committee updates. Executive Committee, I, on behalf of the Executive Committee, want to report two things. First, President Skorton has approved Resolution 4. This is the resolution to modify the campus code to disclose misconduct of university-registered organizations. He did find one correction, and it was administrative, and I've already, on behalf of the UExec, approved the change because it did not impact the intent or the, he caught something we should have. There was one, when he put it out though, he did make one clarification to remind you that it's in the student code and it applies to student organizations, not to non-student organizations. That's what the code governs and that's what it affects. So there was a concern perhaps from his office or some office that maybe we didn't understand the scope of it. If a business service center violates the rules, they won't be put up on the website. The second thing was that President Skorton has announced the nomination of, or actually the selection, but it's essentially the nomination of Emily Sanchirico to be the Judicial Codes Counselor beginning July 1, 2015. Which means effective July 1 of 2014, she would be the Associate Judicial Codes Counselor. Judicial Codes Counselors do require the confirmation of the UA, so I am notifying you that we will ask your confirmation consent at the next meeting on April 8th. Questions for me of the Executive Committee? None? Campus Infrastructure? Mr. Reese Calderon, anything else?
I've been receiving personally a lot of emails in regards to the TCAT proposal, so this meeting, this month, is going to be a revolve around meeting with the faculty, the board members, Mr. Ben David and Ms. Kelly, and the entire committee to address those issues, to address possible other alternatives. I continue receiving these creative alternatives, which have been similar propositions have been brought up to them, but those specifically, I'll bring up some propositions to them, and just to clarify more things and just be able to address all the issues, because I would imagine that our next meeting, it would be a larger press, so preparing for that.
Well, remember that we're putting it up for public comment, so
yeah.
They should come to that meeting. But I, like Mr. Measy says, if they have some really good stuff, if all of a sudden something comes up, let's not surprise you, and let's keep everybody informed if something comes up midstream, because we're running out of time to pass anything. The university is going to have to make a decision whether they have our input or not. I would prefer them to have our input, such that it may be. Any questions for Mr. Ruiz Calderon? Campus welfare, Mr. Moore?
No updates besides just the resolution we have before the assembly now.
Thank you, sir. Codes and judicial, Mr. Measy.
After our last resolution, so we'll be picking up sometime here shortly if there's any topics that you refer to us.
Policy Advisory Group, Professor Lowe is in Panama. I won't tell you what he said. He said, well, I'm warm. You get the context. He went to a PAG meeting recently. There were changes made in the rules governing international travel by all students, staff, and faculty. There were no surprises. A wording change to the regulations. He didn't specify what they were, but it was not that they're changing that we can or cannot. It was getting all our regulations in line, which is all I can tell you there. Are there any late additions to the agenda or any other items that the members wish to discuss? If not, then I remind you we will have a meeting April 8th, this room, to discuss the divestment and carbon neutrality, as well as to hopefully approve the nomination of the JCC. The meeting on April 22nd is currently all slated to addressing and passing, denying, or otherwise the resolutions you heard tonight. And then there would normally be a closed meeting on May 6th to elect the executive committee and or committee chairs, et cetera, for the next session. We all turn into pumpkins except for the newly elected executive committee on May 7th. That May 6th meeting, however, may have to discuss, depending on what you want to do, any resolution on carbon neutrality. So there may have to be a portion of that meeting that would be open. Ordinarily, it's a eat food, shake hands, high five, but depending on what we do on the 8th, we may have work to do in addition to electing the next year's slate. Question, Ms. Bailey?
Oh.
Okay. Any other questions for me?
I have a quick one.
Ma'am.
We don't have their names, but the SA just had their elections, and we have two new undergrad UA reps that will have been elected.
Wonderful.
Yep.
Do they want a chair?
You stay where you are.
Motion to adjourn.
No,
motion to adjourn.
Yeah,
unanimous consent to adjourn.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.